I'd like to introduce our next speaker. Dr. O'Connell spoke in our mid-morning session next door. He is a clinical psychologist who lives in Seattle, Washington over the last 35 years. Dr. O'Connell has worked as an educator, consultant, clinician, department chair, and executive director in medical, behavioral health, and educational settings. He is consultant to the Institute of Healthcare Communication and serves on the faculty of the Foundation for Medical Excellence. He teaches in the residency program at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Dr. O'Connell also maintains a coaching and consulting practice, working primarily with healthcare organizations and individual providers on all aspects of psychology of medicine, leadership in healthcare settings, and professional interactions. Help me welcome Dr. O'Connell.
Here, huh? Well, okay, so one last topic. Some things that I have hinted at along the way is, since I've mostly been talking about difficult encounters that we tend to have, this is what we call the foundation. So when we find, when our clinicians do some of the things I'm about to share with you, they tend to have fewer difficult encounters. But there's three things that we track pretty closely that may irritate you when I tell you. We track at UCLA and at UW very closely patient satisfaction. Now, I think some of the measures are silly, but I believe that we want our patients to be satisfied. When I look at some of the items on a Press-Ganey patient satisfaction scale, I'd say if my mother went to a doctor's visit and I called her and said, "Mom, how did the visit go?" those would be the things I'd ask her about. Did the doctor seem aware of your concerns and worries? Did she share you in decisions about your care? Did she explain things to you in terms you could understand? If she put you on a medicine, did she tell you? So when I look at the items on some of these patient satisfaction questionnaires, I said, yeah, those are pretty good questions. Now, whether the numbers or the metrics are correct, you know, I got my suspicions, and probably so do you. But we take patient satisfaction seriously because we say if we're providing good care, we'd like the patient to agree. We also pay a lot of attention to efficiency. And we look at time efficiency, but we also look at resource efficiency. Because some of you may have seen the research. If you wanted a cheap trick to improve patient satisfaction, just give everybody everything they want. All the opiates, all the tests, all the surgeries, all the studies, and get them out of there. Well, but we pay attention to that stuff too, right? You'll have the DEA visiting you soon. If your patient satisfaction is the result of an unlimited supply of benzos and opiates, and you'll have a medical director like me visiting you if you have the highest rate of diagnostic imaging and subspecialty referrals in a group of 1,200 doctors. So it was always both and, but we take resource use seriously. And time is one of the resources we think, your time is what we think some of the most valuable resource a patient could experience, as well as the x-rays and stuff. And then the third thing we pay attention to, which is frankly the thing that interests me the most, is what is the likelihood that the patient will agree with you and do what you suggested? And the reason why we watch that closely, and some of you who do look at health economics, if you had to have one item that you tracked to answer the question, how valuable was the visit? It would be, did the patient agree with the doctor's diagnosis, and was he or she willing to follow the treatment plan? So keep that in the back of your mind as I share some ideas with you. All three. Is the patient feeling satisfied? Are we using our resources and our time wisely? And are we always increasing the chance that the patient and I will agree on a sensible next step to do with their treatment plan? So here's how we would go. I still have no other commercial content other than thank you for helping me pay off my child's college tuition, which is a beautiful thing, and I appreciate that. Things we've said earlier, still true. If you want to have satisfying visits with patients, do not get irritated at them. It is patients, like most humans, have very finely developed antenna for when people are irritated with them, and it is almost always going to lead to low satisfaction. Almost every patient satisfaction questionnaire says, please rate the warmth, courtesy, and friendliness of the provider. By the way, if you did a focus group of your own patients and you said to them, or your mother, what is the ideal demeanor of a doctor? I can tell you one of the top 3 to 4 adjectives will be warm and friendly. So any of us sitting out there right now who would say our patients do not describe us as warm and friendly are probably in a hole already with regard to patient satisfaction, which does not mean you have to be an extroverted clown, but it means you have to communicate some sense of warmth and connection to patients. In any event, as I've said before, the great ones don't see the people as the problem. They see the people, the patients, as someone with whom they're trying to solve the problem. And that is a very different way to think, right? And then finally, patients and families. If you were to look at an item on a question, patient satisfaction questionnaire, one of them that we have on ours, and it's, did the clinical provider spend enough time with you today, which is on almost every satisfaction, the highest correlation with that is, were my questions answered? So put that in the back of your mind as I make a couple of more comments, right? When do I want to know what the patient's questions are if the highest correlation with I spend enough time with them is I answered their questions? And if you're like me, I want to know their questions immediately. If I'm a neurosurgical subspecialist, a gastroenterologist, a neurologist, a cardiologist, then I'm going to start most of my visits by saying, let's make a list of the concerns and questions you wanted to be sure we addressed today. I don't care if I'm a neurosurgeon, I'm meeting you for the first time, and you've got radiculopathy down your right leg, and I already, having done this for 23 years, I'm on automatic pilot almost in this evaluation and treatment plan. Do not forget there is a customer in front of you who has not been doing this for 23 years, who came to this visit with a set of concerns and questions, and that is really what you're there to do. And by the way, as you'll see from techniques I offer, it is shockingly easy to do, because one of the easiest things you could ever say to a patient is, let's make a list of the concerns and questions you want to be sure we address today. So keep this in the back of your mind. Highest correlation with satisfaction, did you answer their questions? And yet I watch visit after visit where we're 15 minutes into a 30-minute visit and I still couldn't tell you, does the doctor know what the patient's questions are? The patient's complaining about their symptoms, right? Where there's a lot of complaining going on, right? But I don't have a sense of what are the questions. My favorite visit, patient walks in the clinician's agenda, and she has one presenting problem, but it's chronic fatigue. I am tired all the time. I can hear the doctor sigh. It's like the black hole of primary care medicine, right? The sucking sound is detectable. So this poor doctor then, of course, tries to find and fix this. In 15, 20 minutes, she's going to somehow discover why this woman's tired, solve the problem, convince her of it, put her... I'm saying, this is just... Let's change this. So here's how we change it. We turn to the woman and we say, what do you think is contributing to your being so tired? And we get a sensible set of answers. Could be this, maybe I'm not getting enough sleep, but my thyroid's been bad in the past. When I was in college, I was anemic, maybe that's going on. Maybe it's my deadbeat husband's not willing to help with the kids. I mean, people, a question like, what do you think is contributing to your being so tired, is not rocket science. Most people can answer that, unless they've been intimidated by doctors in the past and they think you're not serious, in which case we just repeat the question. We just say, no, honestly, Chad, why do you think you're so tired? People answer that in our clinics. It is enormously useful to know why that person thinks they're so tired. Because in the 9 million things that can contribute to tiredness, the patient's now going to partner with you. And all of a sudden, you're going to have a doable 15-minute visit. Because what she says next is probably going to give you a pretty good clue at what she expected from this visit, what her questions are. We want to know those right away. So when she says, could it be my thyroid, I'm anemic, I'm not sleeping, I'm anxious all the time, maybe I've got Epstein-Barr virus, right? Now we have a question. And very often, the next thing we encourage the clinician to do is to find out the answer to the most crucial question in every medical visit, which in our view is, how were you hoping I could help you with that? We watch doctors, myself and all of us, go round and around and round. I don't care if it's a 30-minute visit, an hour visit, a 5-minute visit, and you watch the clinician does not have a clear sense of how was the patient hoping I could help today. They're in your 10 o'clock schedule today, not yesterday, not tomorrow, today. And by the way, when we do this as research, more than half of the patients have a very specific so you're a woman and you made eye contact, so you're in it now. So I look at you and say, what do you think is causing you to be so tired? I could say causing. We like contributing better. Because causing puts people on the spot, you know, what's the one thing? But if I say, what do you think is contributing to your being so tired? Most patients will give me some of their theories about contributing. Almost always that will give the clinician an opening to the next question, which is, in light of the fact that you don't think you're getting enough sleep, how were you hoping I could be most helpful to you today? Can you see how that would help the average primary care medical visit? When do you want to know she wants Ambien, Lunesta, Sunesta? You to call her husband and tell him to get up his fat ass and actually help with the kids at night. A letter to her boss saying that her, whatever this woman wants, a thyroid test. And by the way, our experience is when you have an openness to your demeanor, warm and respectful, people will answer the question. Because most of them are sitting there with an expectation. They have the internet. They have Dr. Oz. Come on now. In any event, keep these things in mind. Couple of things that make this more likely is a lot of us don't get the staff to help us as much as they could. In our clinics right now at UW, we try to get every clinician to have a huddle with his or her medical assistant or their supporting nurse person for 3 to 5 minutes before the start of morning and afternoon clinic. And here's how it looks. If I'm your medical assistant, we open up your clinic schedule. We say, so Dan, good to see you. We meet at the same time, 7:45 before an 8 o'clock patient, 12:45 before the 1 o'clock patient. The doctor and I gather. We pull up every patient on the computer he's going to see. And at a very perky pace, we go, okay, what do we know about this person? Bring them back into conscious memory. Mr. O'Connell, that's right. He's a 63-year-old guy. He used to be okay, right? Then we say, what do we know about why they're coming? What do we need to make their visit effective? Are there labs? Are there diagnostic imaging reports? Is there some consult? Did I ask for an MRI scan? Where's that report? And then they move on to the next patient. And when we find our doctors do this, we have many fewer problems in the flow of the clinic in the morning and afternoon. You don't walk into a room at 10 o'clock and there's an 85-year-old guy sitting there and you say, well, how can I help you? And he goes, well, I was in the emergency room all night long. Have you ever had this experience? And you're going, I didn't know that. And now you get that sick feeling, right? The guy was sick enough to be in the emergency room. I have no idea why he was there, and I've got 15 minutes to keep him from crumping further. Wouldn't you rather at 7:45 in the morning to have said, Mr. Sanders, is my 10 o'clock patient's an emergency room follow-up? Do we have anything from that emergency room, Dan? Wouldn't you rather I had 2 hours and 15 minutes to try to find out which emergency room he was in and what they did over there? Huddles. The other thing we do in huddles is we pick up on immediate operational issues. Because the doctors who get frustrated, they're often blindsided. So that's when I'm the MA, I say, and by the way, well, the other MAs are out sick today, so I'm going to be rooming patients for 4 doctors. That means I'm probably not going to be as available as usual. What would be the highest priorities? If you don't do this, and there are 2 MAs out sick, and you're walking the halls in search of your MA, muttering and sputtering, that could have been headed off. We could have readjusted our price. You could have said to me, Dan, job number one, room the patient as soon as they come. Faxing, secondary, if you get a chance. But I can tell you, I watch visits unfold all morning long where the clinician falls into one trap after the other. Half of them could have been anticipated by a simple huddle. And by the way, if you're seeing 12 patients in a half day, which is what we ask our internists to do, a 5-minute huddle is 30 seconds a patient. This is a perky pace. This is not a staff meeting. But the other thing we're seeing, which we love, is much more bonding between the clinician and his or her support staff. We don't get this anymore. I just room the patients. Your doctor will be in a moment. I don't actually know who your doctor is, but if you have an appointment, they're probably coming soon. Which is diabolical. It's horrible. How many of you are still in a practice of just you and maybe 1 or 2 other providers? Is anybody still? And do you have dinosaur? In the old days, people's MA was their wife, their nurse, their dad. They've been together for 23 years. The patients built a relationship with the support staff. Now we have clinics where it's like industrial strength medicine, right, which could be okay, except the families don't build any relationship with the support staff, which means who is the only consistent relationship they have? With whom? You. Which means you're returning every phone call, filling out every form, answering every question till 9 o'clock at night. We don't like that at UW. We're now building micro teams because we want the patient to identify with a specific limited number of staff so that when the patient calls afterwards and says, well, Dr. O'Connell told me to take methotrexate and the pharmacist told me that could make my eyeballs fall out. I don't want to get on the phone, right? I want my MA to get on the phone. I want my MA to say, hi, this is Brenda. Dr. O'Connell asked me to give you a call. He knows about concerns about methotrexate, but he has reviewed your chart and sees you at no particular risk and thinks it's a great medicine for your arthritis. He's encouraging you to give it a try. And we want the patient to say to the MA, thank him for me. But what we were finding at UCLA is if there wasn't a connection between the clinician, the physician, and her MA, then the patient was likely to say, I'm preferring to talk to Dr. O'Connell about that. Maybe he could call me later. Which, come on, I'd be happy to call you later, but I'd rather go watch my daughter play soccer before she is in the nursing home. And I don't think that's unfair to do, that I have a life. So start to see things that we're talking about help you, help patients, and help make the job more manageable. How many of you use a computer in the exam room? Okay, so you probably know that most patients think a modern doctor should be using a computer in the exam room. Okay, but again, some things, comments I made the other day. But when we ask them, what do you like and what don't you like, they're often very specific about what they do not like. So we just use the computer in the way they like. And the way they like is they like the doctor who has a computer if they see how the doctor's using the computer in their visit to enhance their care now. So if you're my patient, I'm going to be talking to them, say, give me a second to log on so we can take advantage. Constantly talking about how this computer enhances your care today. I can see when your next cardiology appointment is scheduled. And if it's just a week or two, then I'd say, let's defer that for your cardiologist because she's more on top of these medicines. See, if I can see all that, I'm a primary care doctor, and you say, what about this? And I know you're seeing a specialist. Now I can open up the note of the specialist. I can say, let's take a look at your gastroenterologist's note and remind ourselves of what her suggestions were for your diet. When you do this in front of the patient, it goes from being an expensive word processing tool that has nothing to do with them and a billing tool to something they see being utilized. They love it. We turn the screen so they can see it, right? If it's a tool for collaboration, they should see it, right? When we're typing, we say to them, would it be okay with you if I get some of this down while it's fresh in my mind? Almost nobody in my experience objects when you ask their permission. But when we don't ask their permission, we get many more complaints about why is the doctor doing so much typing? Because they don't know why the doctor was doing so much typing. They didn't see how it enriched their care. If we're going to type for more than a couple of minutes, we say, not minutes, seconds, we say, we talk out loud while we're typing. So let me see if I have this correctly, Amy. So your headache has been bothering you on and off since you were a teenager. You had a period of years where it wasn't a problem, but then in the last few years, it's become a bigger problem, and I'm the third neurologist that you've consulted about this. If that's what she's saying, and I need to get that history in the computer, I'd rather do it while she's sitting there than 9 o'clock tonight. But I want her to feel that my typing that in is enhancing an accurate history, not taking my attention away from her. So I talk out loud while I'm typing. She gets to correct the history if it's incorrect, rather than me amend this note 3 days from now. Right? And that is also something. When we do the treatment plan, we talk out loud while we do the treatment. So Chad, so it sounds like there's four things we want to do differently. So the first thing is we're going to increase your disipramine and see how much that helps with the mood. The next thing is you're going to try to drink less liquor. Number three is you're going to get back to getting some aerobic exercise because you did better, didn't you? And number four is anything you could do to get on a more regular sleep cycle would really be enormously helpful because this depression thing. Go to bed even if you don't feel tired. And then I print this out and I give it to them. Patient's highest satisfaction in one of our clinics was, I got to take something away in writing. Does that make sense to you? I mean, without enduring material, something he can read when he gets home. And by the way, we add websites to this thing. We'll say, and by the way, Chad, my patients tell me that there's this YouTube video. It may sound crazy to you, but it's a guy talking about how he finally got on top of his bipolar illness after years of non-adherence. My patients tell me that this is incredibly inspiring. If I put the link to the YouTube video, promise me you'll take a look. I give out YouTube video recommendations constantly to people. We actually have post-surgical wound instructions on YouTube. I mean, come on, what if you're gonna take care of your wife's wound, your mother's wound, which is better, to have a video you can watch 12 times that tells you how to do this, what an infection looks like, or some doctor telling you if it gets red, that means, come on, when I recently changed the toilet bowl, and I'm a half-assed home repair person. Before I changed the toilet, I went to YouTube. How many of you do this? I got a YouTube of doing this thing. I watched the damn thing 3 times. I put my laptop on the sink, and I successfully, usually my plumbing problems end up with us having no hot water for days. This is 2016. Come on, let's get modern. Patients have many sources of information that are better than us talking at them. as long as we link to that thing that Chad doesn't see. Chad, there's so much more that a patient needs to understand when he's newly diagnosed with bipolar illness. Much more than I could tell you today. The good news is there are two books written by people with bipolar. One of them is a psychologist at Stanford, Redfield firm. She does a beautiful job. Promise me you'll pick up this book and take a look at it. Does that mean he's going to do it? I don't know, but you know, it's a darn good book. And for my patients newly diagnosed with bipolar disorder, to have a smart psychologist who teaches at a university, and she gets to tell you how she came to make her peace with this crazy diagnosis, and my patients tell me that's incredibly inspirational. It doesn't cost me another minute. And it's 10 hours worth of support group when they're ready to do it. In any event, that's the computer in the exam room, right? Ideal demeanor we've spoken about. Listen, if you want to talk about risk management, which I know has come up a lot today, two different doctors see your mother. One of them seems cool, remote, somewhat brusque, very scientific and quite formal, and fails to recognize that your mother has an abdominal blockage. The second doctor is warm, says, boy, those shoes look nice with that purse, and I'm sorry to hear that your stomach has been so upset. And she also misses the diagnosis for a whole visit. Which one is your family more likely to sue? And you could say, oh, you see that. You know, if you're going to be a crappy doctor, have a nice bedside demeanor, you'll get away with murder. No correlation. Some of the worst technical doctors we have are also the meanest. And some of the warmest doctors we have are technically incredibly competent. Why the patient is less likely to sue you is the psychology, which says, I think all doctors are smart. Right? Most of them think if you're licensed, you're smart, right? But they're not sure how much you care, right? See what's happening here. The one who likes my mother, who greets my mother warmly, gets the benefit of the doubt, or that doctor was trying as hard as possible because he really cares. The one who's a bit brusquer, remote, right, serious, does not get the benefit of the doubt about caring. They're assumed to be smart. But most patients, if you look at a lawsuit, most patients suing us, it's very emotional what they're going through. And they feel things emotionally. And again, as Amy's been showing, body language, voice tone, and body language and voice tone take no more time to convey that sense of warmth. In any event, enough with that. Agenda setting we've talked about. One of our main strategies is we will not let our doctors be 90 seconds into a visit without an agenda. Let's make a list of the things you wanted to go over with me today. Primary care, I mentioned this before, 3.8 is normal in internal medicine, 3.4 in internal medicine, 2.8 in family medicine. Any of you in this room are primary care doctors who do not have an agenda, you better have another way of budgeting and understanding time. Because this stuff is, oh, by the way, is all day long. And when patients, remember, patient satisfaction, highest correlation, did the doctor spend enough time with me, is my questions were answered. If you don't know what the patient's questions are, then you're at risk of spending time with them and not getting to the heart of the matter and getting dinged for satisfaction, even if you spent... I've watched doctors say, I spent 40 minutes with those people at a 20-minute visit, and they had the nerve to complain that I didn't spend enough time with them. And I'll say, oh, yes, because you didn't get to the heart of the matter in the 40-minute visit, right? You didn't know what their questions were. Let's get their questions. Let's make a list of the things you want to go over. And by the way, we use our medical assistants to start that. Our medical assistants were heavily computerized. When Dan is taking the vital signs of his patient, Dan is also trained to say, and before the doctor comes in a moment, let's start to make a list of the things you want to go over with him. We do not want our patients reading old Sports Illustrated magazines, cutting out recipes, playing Candy Crush on their iPhone. We don't want our patients distracted before their visit. We want them focused before their visit. In half our clinics, we give a little sheet. The patient registrar gives a sheet that says, doctor's looking forward to seeing you in a moment to focus your visit. It would help if you answer the following questions. First question is, please make a list of the things you want to go over with your doctor in today's visit. And we want the patient thinking about writing in that list before the start of the visit, not distracting themselves. If you're not doing this already, consider the specialists as well. If this is a follow-up visit, if I'm a surgeon, if I did your laparoscopic cholecystectomy last week, I'm still going to start by saying, so this is a follow-up visit following your laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and I'm sure there's a number of things I always go over when I'm seeing a patient for the first time after they've been discharged from the hospital. But I like to start by making a list of the concerns and questions you have. Our UCLA hospitalists now do this on rounds. So the hospitalist walks up and says, I'm Dr. O'Connell, I'm the hospitalist physician, going to be taking care of in the hospital for the next day or two. Number of things I want to go over with you, things we have planned for today. But before I go into that, I want to know, you can finish the sentence. What are the concerns and questions you have at this point in your hospitalization? If you're here with your 80-year-old dad, same question. What are the concerns and questions you have about your dad's hospitalization? The way we figure it is if a family member gets to an exam room, they are a player, right? If I come up to his dad's bedside, if people scatter, they said, you know, your doctor's here, I'll go get a coffee, come back later, then the heck with them. But if they're standing by the bedside, we think they're as important as the patient themselves. They have history they want to give. They're evaluating the care. They will be essential to the adherence. If they don't agree with this plan, we're going to have a readmission. So if that man is standing next to his dad's bedside, I'm going to find out who he is. And you are? And what is your relationship? That's wonderful that you could fly in and be with your dad at this point. And so I guess my question for you is, what are the concerns and questions you have about your dad's hospitalization at this point? And that is the way we orient our hospitalists. And we're getting higher satisfaction, and the hospitalists are reporting they're getting paged fewer back to the room, which I don't know if anyone here is a hospitalist, but you can put 20,000 steps together on your pedometer very, very quickly if you don't answer questions and the nurse pages you and says they have another question. In any event, eliciting self-diagnosis. How many of you routinely ask the patient what their theory is about what's causing their symptoms? I hope the rest of you didn't raise your hand because you have a subclinical rotator cuff tear and it's too painful. This is so powerful, you have got to consider doing this. What do you think is contributing to your tiredness? If it's a new problem, what do you think is causing the headaches? If you've had headaches forever, and I'm a neurologist, I'm not going to say what do you think is causing them, you'll think I'm demented. But I am going to say to you, what do you think is causing the headaches to now be more frequent and more intense than they've been for years? If I'm an endocrinologist, I'm not going to say, what do you think is causing your blood sugars to be high? The guy's going to say, read my chart, fool. I have diabetes. But come on, if it's hemoglobin A1, if you just got referred to an endocrinologist from primary care, I'm curious about what his theory is about why his blood sugars have been so less well controlled, because that's going to allow me to have the highest impact, right? If I'm an endocrinologist, I am not fixing your diabetes. I am helping you fix your diabetes. I'm partnering with you. And that means I want to talk to you in a way that leads you to think you are not being fixed here. You are getting good medical advice that we want you to agree with so that when you go home, you're willing to follow it. So we look at you and we say, what do you understand was the reason why your internist referred you to us in endocrinology? What did you understand she was concerned about? What do you think might be contributing to your blood sugars being so less well controlled now than they have been for years? If I'm an OB gynecologist, very similar question. So the woman reports that she's exhausted with this pregnancy, has enormous back pain, right? That she feels very, very uncomfortable. We train our OB to look at that woman right away and say, boy, this is your third pregnancy. What do you think might be causing this pregnancy to be going so differently from Tommy and Frankie's birth? And by the way, if you're doing this, you know what I'm talking about. That woman is going to help you. She and her partner have a theory about why this is happening. It doesn't mean they are right. But come on now, why wouldn't you start with a smart woman who this is her third pregnancy? Why wouldn't you smart by including her as a partner in evaluating the care? I mean, by the way, we're not talking about you being a waiter in a crummy Chinese restaurant. Right? It's not like, tell me what you want and I'll do it. Everyone gets a couple of medicines, two diagnostic imagings, and then an outpatient referral. So just fill in the blank, I'll be in later. One from column A, two from column B, three from... We're not a waiter. We're going to turn every one of these expectations into a question. When do I want to know, though, that you want your father admitted to the hospital? When do I want to know that you think I'm a family practice doc and you think you should be referred to endocrinology? Right? When do I want to know if I'm a pediatrician, which we just saw, and this lovely little kid comes in and she's in tears. The pediatrician's been treating this kid for acne for a year. I'm looking at the kid and I'm thinking, well, I can still see some, you know, and I see a tiny bit of scarring, and I don't even have the magic. Anyone here a dermatologist? I don't have the magic eyeglasses on. And the pediatrician is futzing around quite beautifully. And finally, we turn to the mother and I say, when you came to see Dr. Sanders again today about your daughter's acne, in light of the fact that it's still not as improved as you and your daughter would hope, Was there something different that you were hoping your daughter's pediatrician would do today? What do you think the mother says? I mean, who knows? It's all. She says, don't you think it's time that she gets referred to a dermatologist? I'm saying, okay, here we go. But now we're 12 minutes into this visit. Okay, but that's not the end of the world yet. We give 15 minutes for our... But now the follow-up question. You don't have to immediately do that. You say to the mother, what is it that you would understand a dermatologist might do differently with your 13-year-old's acne than we've been doing so far? And the mother lovingly says they use this medicine called Accutane that I don't think you guys are allowed to use. But if you get the example, you watch enough of these visits, you will never not ask the mother again. In light of the fact that your daughter's acne has not improved as much as you hope, you won't say it this quickly, but in light of the fact that your daughter's acne has not improved as much as you hope, was there something different that you wanted to be sure we consider doing today? And then the mother lovingly looks at you. She doesn't want to offend you, right? But she says, well, I'm just wondering if maybe seeing a person who specializes might help. And you don't get your back up, because don't you want to know before you futz around with the doxycycline for another 3 visits and disappoint her? Don't you want to know? And what is it you understand that a dermatologist might be able to do differently? Listen, if the dermatologist isn't going to do anything differently, then you're going to be in a powerful position to say to the mother, it may surprise you to learn that we look pediatrics, we just had a CME from our dermatologist, and we do exactly what they do. So I think I can spare you a trip to the dermatologist. And by the way, we consult them by phone in situations like your daughter's, and so I can tell you exactly right now what are my dermatology. Now, the mother might still want to go to the dermatologist, but I've watched negotiations go very, very well, simply because we asked. And can you follow the flow? What do you think is contributing to the tiredness? The woman tells you, it gives you a sense of what she was expecting. Then you say, in light of the fact that you think you've been sleeping so poorly, how are you hoping I could be most helpful? And she tells you, if she can, she wants Lunesta, Ambience, right? That doesn't mean she gets it. That just means in the next couple of minutes, you're going to respectfully show that you're paying attention to the safety, the effectiveness, and the risks of Ambien. We're just having a little late Friday lunch, and this is not your exam room. But I got to tell you, we're making this harder than it needs to be, many of us. That's my optimism in some of this, is many of you in this room are much more livid, burnt out, and furious at our patients than you need. Now, some of them are wacky, and they will make your mind bend. But a lot of them are willing to help us if we let them, in any event. Ask about the views of other doctors. How many of you, by the way, are specialists of some kind? What percent of your patients have seen another healthcare provider for the exact same problem for which they saw you this week? Seen another healthcare provider of any kind within the last 6 months for the exact same problem they saw you this week? Shout out some numbers. 85%. Is anyone going higher? Lower? Sideways? If I'm an internist, right? And I know that forget the internist part. I'm a cardiologist. I can pretend to be anything. I wish I could get paid like that, but I'll pretend. I'm a gastroenterologist. Let's stay closer to home. I'm a shrink. Okay, I know a little more about that. And I'm an 150 doctor group in Seattle. And after a while, I figured that all of my patients, almost all of them, had been seen one of my colleagues and got referred to me. Watch what I do. I mean, not because I'm smart, because this is what we're learning. I turn to the patient and I say, so Chad, when Dr. Arnold, your primary care provider, referred you to us in behavior health, what did you understand were the kinds of things we could do to help with depression that perhaps you and he have not been able to do as a primary care provider over the last couple of years? I'm eliciting expectation. All of my patients had seen another healthcare provider in the previous weeks. When do you want to know? If you're a gastroenterologist, when do you want to know what the family practice doctor said? If you're an orthopedic surgeon who just got a referral from a family practice doc, when do you want to know what the family practice doc said? So when your family practice doc referred you to us in orthopedics with that terrible hip pain, what did he tell you he thought was causing the hip pain to be so excruciating? Why wouldn't you ask? And did he give you a sense of the kinds of ways we tend to approach this in orthopedics? Why wouldn't you ask? It's the easiest, most efficient question you can ask. You're going to find out what the patient knows already. You're going to find out where the piles of dog poop are so you don't step in them. By which I mean, have you ever prattled on for 25 minutes and then discovered that you have contradicted everything that this person's beloved primary care provider has said and essentially set them up for a lawsuit? Oh, we would never, no doctor would ever do that. No, that's out of the question. I mean, we stopped doing that decades ago. Well, my doctor put, it's like, oh no, why didn't I say to you? Summarize for me the kinds of things you and your primary care provider have been doing so far to help with that. Why wouldn't I do that as a specialist? It only brings me good stuff. And by the way, how many of your primary care providers? What percent of the patients you saw this week have seen a specialist for the exact same problem in the last 6 months because you referred them? I've watched primary care visits that would made me crazy, but they're actually funny. So here's a recent visit, but this is normal visit. Lovely family practice doc. There are four agenda items. So it's something about skin, something about stomach, something about sleep, and an ortho kind of, my knee swells up. Here we start with the skin one. She says, well, let me take a look at that. She looks at this lesion. She goes, oh, I think that's an evi. I think that's going to be okay. The patient says, yeah, that's what my dermatologist said. Slow learner club. Let's go on. But she's learned to do agenda setting, so we know what the four things are. We go on to the stomach one. Lovely family practice doc starts again with, when does it hurt, what makes it worse, doesn't, he says this whole thing and says, well, you know, I think what's happening here is reflux, and I think you're eating a big meal late at night, right, and I think some of the foods and the regurgitation, and does this beautiful thing, and the patient, you're going to think I'm lying, says to her, yeah, that's kind of what my gastroenterologist thought. Still no learning. Third agenda item. Family practice doc goes after it exactly the way. Find it and fix it. Like I'm the only doctor on the surface of the earth. And I'm ready to fall off my chair laughing at this point. And this is a doctor who runs way behind. This visit could have been over 13 minutes ago. Because what we'd have trained the doctor to do is, did you have a chance, have you spoken with any other healthcare providers about that thing on your leg? In which case the patient would have said, yeah, I saw my dermatologist last week. We'd have trained the family practice doctor to say, what did your dermatologist say? She thinks it's a freckle, it's an EVI, you don't have to worry about it. It's not an actinic keratosis, you don't have to freeze it off. And we'd have had the family practice doctor say, makes sense to me. Let's move on to your next item. It's like the patient-centered medical home. You don't have to solve every problem. They just want you to know about them. But I've watched doctors do this. I mean, I don't even remember the fourth one. No, the fourth one was an orthopedic one. And that was not a doctor. That was a chiropractor. How many of you now are already grinding your teeth? Come on now. There were more visits to non-allopathic physicians last year paid for out of pocket than to allopathic physicians. People are going to naturopaths, chiropractors, faith healers, all kinds of stuff. And so stop getting angry about that. But remember, if the person's paying out of pocket to see a chiropractor and they've got a musculoskeletal problem, would you kind of like to know what the chiropractor said? Our neurosurgeons, at first blush, I thought they were going to kill us when we suggested this. They hate chiropractors. I said, for God's sake, we're in Seattle. There are more chiropractors than Baptist churches. Everybody who's got a bad back in Seattle goes to see a chiropractor. Well, what are you gaining by not asking? So reluctantly, we got a couple of them say, so have you been seeing a chiropractor or anybody about this? And the patients, they're wary because they understand neurosurgeons don't like this. But, you know, a couple of the brave ones say, yeah, I've been seeing a chiropractor. And now you could see the neurosurgeon getting angry. And like, take a breath, man. Next question. What did your chiropractor tell you she thought was the reason why your back was continuing to bother you so much despite 711 spinal manipulations? I'm teasing a little bit. These guys, it's changed their lives. I'm sure they have fewer peptic ulcers even on the basis of this. Ask for the diagnosis. By diagnosis, I mean self-attribution. I just mean, what's your theory? I'm a child psychologist, so I look at you and I say, so Tommy's having a terrible time in third grade, and we're finishing the school year, and the teacher said to him that she thinks he should repeat third grade. Oh, that must have been very upsetting. Always empathy, always warmth. Tone of voice is warm, undivided attention is warm, body language is warm. I'm not typing away like a crazy person. When you say that, I look up, and I say, boy, that must have been tough news to hear. But my next question is going to be, What did your son's third grade teacher say she thought was causing Tommy to be having such a difficult time learning this year? Come on, she's a professional. I'm a child psychologist or pediatrician, right? When do you want to know what the teacher said? I'd say about now. And then the mother looks and says, well, she thinks he's got ADHD. And what did you understand that to mean? Right? You waste time when you tell people stuff they know already. You add value you when you find what is it they don't know or what is it they think they know, which is inaccurate. So we turn to the mother and we say, and what did you understand the ADHD mean? And the mother turns out to be very sophisticated. He can't sit still, he bothers the other children, he doesn't finish homework, he doesn't turn in assignments. I'm saying, okay, that's a pretty good list there. So then I said, so what do you think the next question is going to be? We'll stop 10 minutes early if you can answer this. So when you came down to see us today in behavioral health, in light of the fact that you met with your child's third grade teacher and she told you she thinks Tommy has ADHD, how were you hoping we could be most helpful to you? My life became so much easier about 23 years ago when I started to learn these techniques and use them. And by the way, as a shrink, I didn't think we needed them. My whole department did not want to go to communication skills training. 5 psychiatrists, 5 psychologists, we all think we knew better. My boss insisted we go to a training, communication skills training, that was intended for you guys. And I sat there the whole time saying, wow, I don't do that. That would really help. In any event, enough of that. How about the views of other doctors? Well, we just said it. If a vast number of your patients have seen another healthcare provider for the exact same bloody problem they're seeing today, when do you want to know? At UCLA, we looked at this. A third of the patients being seen by a UCLA specialist had seen another specialist in the same specialty within 6 months. I'm sure at UC San Diego, same thing happens. I go to Hopkins 12 days a year, same thing. UW, same thing. Right? People are getting second opinions, third opinions. When do you want to know, if you're a neurologist, have you ever spoken with any other neurologist about those headaches? And the patient says, yes. I don't care if it was 30 years ago. I want to know. And I know it was a long time ago, but what do you remember your neurologist saying she thought was the reason why you were having those headaches? Come on. Just incredibly helpful. Right? Well, and when patients come to UCLA for a fourth opinion, the worst thing you could do is start from scratch. No, the best thing you do is say, tell me a little bit more. I know you were dissatisfied with your 5 previous cardiologists, your 5 previous rheumatologists, but let me be sure that I understand what, if any, value. So what did your last cardiologist tell you she thought was the reason why your heart beat like that? And the patient said, they don't tell me anything. And I don't believe it. How many of you are cardiologists? You tell people stuff, right? You don't say, get out of my office, read about it later, I'm tired of seeing. You know, you looked at the patient and you said something about why you thought that heartbeat irregularity wasn't dangerous. So when the patient says, I don't know, the guy never said anything about it, I don't believe him, but I gently start to extract the value, right? And I know it's frustrating, it's hard to follow these specialists sometimes. Like emergency room, this is a classic for us, right? They come back from the emergency room and I say, what did the emergency room doctor tell you? No, he didn't say anything. I sat there for hours, they did a bunch of tests, they couldn't find anything. They said, go see your primary care provider. That's just not true. I spend a lot of time with emergency room doctors. They don't do that. But why is the patient claiming that there was so little value? We have to help the patient get the value. So we said, yeah, it sounds like the emergency room doctor, it wasn't exactly clear to her why your dad was so dizzy. But remind me, what did she tell you she thought were some of the reasons why he might be so dizzy? Right? And all of a sudden, we're extracting the value of a previous consult. When the thing started, she didn't tell me anything, she had no idea, she's sensing her. No, that didn't happen. They did stuff in the emergency room. They made decisions. They talked things over. And did she suggest, when she said to you, see your dad's primary care provider on Monday, did she give you a sense of how we were likely to approach it in light of the fact that he was dizzy enough to go to the emergency room? If she gave him an expectation, I want to know it now. Well, he said you're almost certainly going to do an MRI scan. You're almost certainly going to refer him to neurology. You're almost certainly going to take him off all those medicines that cause orthostatic hypotension because she thinks that's what's making dad dizzy. I just want to know. That doesn't mean I'm going to do what the ER doc said, but that is going to be one of our biggest questions for today. Sounds like one of our biggest questions for today is, are the medicines for your dad's blood pressure, the ones that we know can cause some dizziness, are those the ones accounting for this, or is there something else? I'm not arguing with the ED doc, but I don't want to be walking around here not knowing that the ED doc said, oh, he's going to have to reduce your dad's lisinopril, oh, he's going to have to take him off the verapamil. Almost certainly the medicines are causing that problem. Have you ever been halfway through a visit, and you know, the ER doc had a whole conversation, and the only one in this room who does not know what they said is you. Don't let that happen to you again. It is easy to have that not happen. You simply say, have you spoken to any other healthcare providers about this problem? The patient usually will tell you the truth unless they're seeking opiates. And some of them will tell you the truth too. And then you just simply inquire, and what were you told? What do you know? What have you been? In any event, consider that. Short summaries are helpful because patients say a lot of stuff. And one of the ways to convince patients you understand what they're saying is you summarize what they're saying. Because I could sit here all day long and say, oh, I understand. No, I know. Hop up on the table, let's do an exam. And you have to talk to the patient. They're not convinced I know anything. But if I can give a short summary of what they said, that is impressive. So I look at you and I say, just let me be sure I got this correctly. Headaches on and off for years. Medicines in the past, haven't felt the need for them though for the last couple of years, but for the last month you've been having excruciating headaches and your vision gets weird, and then you go lie down and you put stuff over your eyes, and in about five, and do I have that correct? Hop up on the table. That took me 5 seconds to say, that short summary. I can tell you it's one of the highest correlations with the item that says the doctor understands my concerns and worries. But a lot of us don't do it. A lot of us go, hop up on the table. It's a good use of 5 seconds. If you can convince a patient, and by the way, if the patient has a tendency to repeat herself or himself, that's the best way to stop that, is to do the short summary. Because when you ask to a patient, when I do this stuff, I'll walk out the door and I'll say to the patient, anything about today's visit you wish had gone differently? And I'll have noticed the patient repeated the same story 4 times. Right? So I'm curious, but I won't say that. Why did you go on and on like that? I'll say, anything you wish had gone differently. And then I might gently say, I noticed that you kind of felt the need to tell Dr. Sanders a very similar story a number of times. And I just wonder, what led you to do that? What do you think is almost always what the patient says is the reason they repeated their story multiple times? I wasn't sure he... By the way, when you go home tonight, and if you're lucky enough to have a spouse who still loves you, and you think back on the last fight you had with that spouse that went on for days, and you're about to like have a homicide-suicide pact because she's about to, or he's about to tell the story from the start, and you say, honey, before I shoot you and then me, put our both out of our miseries, let me see if I can summarize why you're so upset with me. This is a great thing to do in a marriage. And you turn to your partner and say, honey, I think you're not just mad, I think you're heartbroken. And I think that's because I promised you I wasn't going to travel so much. And right after making that promise, we went through my schedule and you saw I was going to be in Ogden for 2 days. And it really led you to feel, what's the point of negotiating with Dan? Because he's going to do what he damn well wants anyway. Is that why you're so upset? Does it sound like this might be true? Like I might have had this conversation on the phone last night? That is what allows you to move on. Because at least now we have on the table her motion and her theory. And I stopped saying things, oh, well, one of us has to work. Which, by the way, was not a winning strategy. You do have to interrupt sometimes, right? Are there patients who do go on? Are there patients who do? If I said to you, what percent of your patients even know how much time was set aside for today's visit? I mean, seriously. What percent of your patients know how much time was set aside for today's visit? I've never seen it be more than 50%. So let's not hold them accountable for going on. They have no idea how much time you set aside. So we don't encourage this in every, but if I'm working with a doctor who has fallen into the habit of falling very far behind, I will encourage them to talk frankly about time. I don't always encourage this, because I think calling out time has its own unintended consequences. But if you've been a half hour late for lunch, if you're going to change that habit, you're going to have to get time emblazoned in your mind. So we'll say to a patient, Chad, they've set aside 20 minutes for today's visit. I would not ordinarily say that unless I'm trying to break the habit of poor time management. And that allows me and Chad to kind of get oriented. So Chad, they've set aside 20 minutes for today's visit. And there's a number of things I wanted to go over with you from your last visit, but I like to start by making a list of the concerns and questions you have. And if my MA's been doing this, I'm going to say, and when Brenda was taking your vital signs, she mentioned, remember wherever the agenda came from, and then I'm going to negotiate with you. If it's more than we can do justice to in today's visit, let's bargain now. You know, Chad, as I see there's a number of things that you're concerned about. I'm afraid if we try to take all that on in today's visit, that I might end up giving you quick answers to questions that deserve more careful thought. But let's pick the things we can get a solid start on today. And I don't want you leaving here without a plan for how everything gets taken care of over the next few visits. Sound fair? When our docs do this at the beginning, set an agenda. If the agenda is more than can be done, negotiate the agenda now with the patient participating. We have much more respect, much fewer problems. And by the way, we learn to say things like, if we take on too much, there's a risk I'll give you quick answers to questions that deserve more careful thought. We teach our doctors to say things like, you know, Chad, if we make too many changes in your medications today, the problem will be we won't know what's causing what in a week or two. So my suggestion is let's just change the effexor today and let's leave your antihypertensive medicine where it is and let's see how the effexor influences your blood. And then when I see you back in 2 weeks, we'll see how you're doing on the antidepressant dose and we'll have a sense of how your blood pressure's responded. Does that make sense, Chad? I'm not too lazy. I'm willing to talk about this stuff, but I want the patient to see why is it in his best interest we don't overload this visit. Because if the patient's sitting there saying, I took off the afternoon, I mean, what's the rush? Right? Then you could see where that's going to be offensive. But if I say, no, Chad, I don't think you came down here to talk over 12 problems. I think you came down here to make progress on understanding and treating those problems. And Chad, for that, I think we need to be more systematic. We say that to people. By the way, when I say we say that to people, we have docs who have written that on an index card. Right? Because if you're going to change a habit, and you're seeing 25 patients a day, it's asking a lot of yourself to think, to change, to. But if you think any of these techniques are helpful, and you want to remind yourself which ones you want to use on Monday, then take a little time over the weekend to kind of flesh out exactly what am I going to try to do differently and why, so that when you walk in on Monday, you can start to do something different. And if you want to change anything on the basis, I don't even know what the other talks you saw. I saw some of them. If you want to change anything on Monday, be sure that you are very, very clear about what it is you want to change and what you're hoping to get from that change. And don't try to change it with every patient. Any of the techniques I've offered so far, do not do that with more than 1 out of 3 patients on Monday morning. If you've never set agendas before, do not try to do it with all 12 patients. Do every other one and see what happens. Eliciting a self-diagnosis, if you've never done that before, don't do that with every patient. Right? Do it with every other patient. Do it in the morning and not in the afternoon. Right? Do an experiment so you don't feel completely overwhelmed. If you haven't been typing while the patient's talking because you think it's rude and horrible, but you've got too many notes that are open at night, right, and you're starting to confabulate, don't type while every patient's talking. Type while every fourth patient's talking and see if you can get yourself comfortable. And then do it for every 2 out of 4 patients and then 3 out of 4 patients. Right? None of these things need to be changed in a radical, emergent way. This is not a remedial program. And we do need to interrupt people from time to time, and we need to say, let me stop you for just a moment. And that does seem rude, unless I can bridge back to something the patient agrees is more important than what he was going on about. See, if I know your agenda, then when I say, let me stop you for just a moment, because it's less important to me which Hawaiian island you went to than what the emergency room doctor on that Hawaiian island said was the reason why your vision went black in your left eye. Patients will laugh with you when you do that. They get it, they're smart, right? But sometimes they do want to tell you whether it was Maui, and then they'll go, well, maybe it was Kauai. Well, that was last year. You know, which one did we go to this year? And you know, if you had all the time in the world, you'd probably want to hear it. But you don't. So you're going to have to interrupt him. But you don't want him to think you're a rude jerk. So you interrupt him by bridging back to something he agrees is important. Let me stop you for just a second, because I think I understand that part. What I don't understand, though, is what are you weighing when you and your husband decide whether or not to have Tommy immunized? So if I'm going to stop you because you want to give you a summarize for me all the crap that's on the internet about the horrible, you know, the fake problems that are caused by immunization, I'm going to be respectful, but I'm going to stop you. I'm going to say, no, it sounds like you've done a lot of research on the internet and have a number of concerns about the possibility of Asperger's or autism. No, I guess what my question is, Mrs. O'Connell, though, is did you get a chance to read and think a little bit about what the risks are of not immunizing Tommy for those illnesses? See, I'm allowed to stop her if I bridge back to something that she agrees is in her best interest to consider with her pediatrician. So don't be afraid to interrupt people if you can bridge back to something they agree is important. But if you interrupt them and say, we got to move on here. Do you hear the noise in my waiting room? Those people are getting angry. Some of them will break down this door. They will be in here soon. Provide, elicit, provide is a fancy way of saying that many of us would be better off keeping the patient education part of the visit conversational. So poor Chad, I've given him 4 psychiatric diagnoses here, but I know his name, so he's in trouble. So let's say Chad came to see me, and he was tired all the time. I need a woman. What is your first name? Kate. So Kate, you're in now. So Kate came to see me, she was tired all the time. So I had to take seriously, did I have to first work up the thyroid and the anemia? If she thought those were high on the list, and I start talking about depression, before I have answered her question, what's going to happen? Nothing good. I got to take the first visit to either look up her labs or order them and have her come back, right? But I'm going to do something else. Even while I order those, I'm going to say, but Kate, in addition to checking your labs, I've got a little questionnaire here that can sometimes give us very surprising results that sometimes people are struggling with other things like mood as part of their exhaustion. Would you be willing to fill out this questionnaire and then leave it behind? And when you come back in a week, I'll have your labs, and then we'll have the results of this thing. So here we go. Provide, elicit, provide. So now we're 13 minutes into this visit, and I look at Kate and I say, so Kate, here's the provide. It may surprise you to learn that your thyroid and your blood work was all came back very good, but your answers to this PHQ-9 thing, this little questionnaire, they indicated that you have more symptoms of depression than 90 out of 100 women your age would have. Is that, by the way, is that a big provide to this woman who is not thinking depression? Don't keep talking. Don't sell depression therapy. Elicit from her response. Provide a piece of information, get her back in the conversation. So I turn to Kate and I say, Kate, what goes through your mind as you hear me tell you that you're reporting more symptoms of depression than 9 out of 10 women? Let's see what she says. If she says, no, you're right, I was depressed in college, I guess it's back, you can move on to chapter 2. What do you do about depression? But if she says, you think this is all in my mind, then you can't go forward, right? Remember, this is her problem, not yours. You're just giving her your best medical advice. So break the pieces of information into smaller bites and make it more conversational, which is not what I'm doing with you. I'm just yammering at you. But if you were really my patient, I would be talking in much smaller bursts, and I wouldn't go on for a minute before I had you back in this conversation. Right? So I need to know, what are you thinking? What's going through your mind? By the way, the best question you could ever ask a patient, open-ended question, is what's going through your mind as you hear me say that? If you're ever stuck for a question, and the patient's looking at you like you're looking at me, and you say, I need to know what this guy's thinking, the easiest, cheapest question that's valuable is you turn to him and say, it would help if you tell me a little bit more what's going through your mind. I don't care if your female patient is sobbing, and you give her a tissue. By the way, giving a female patient a tissue does not automatically reset the clock so you have 15 more minutes in this visit, right? So you need her to talk while she's sobbing. Am I saying something that's not true here? So you give her the tissues while she's sobbing and you say, I know this is, it looks like this is absolutely overwhelming and heartbreaking, but could you tell me a little bit about what's going through your mind? Right? There's patients who can talk while they're sobbing. There's a lot of patients who need to talk while they're sobbing. We recently had, this happens fairly regularly, but I had like half a bunch of male physicians, half a bunch of female physicians. And the female physician says something like, well, you know, my patient cried. And I turned to the men because I know this. And I said, I'm curious, in what percent of your visits does your patient cry? I could ask you this now, but it would be rare. Male physicians would say, maybe once in a day, possibly. I turn to the female primary care, I don't care, gynecologist, female doctor, nurse practitioner, PI. I say, what percent of your patients cry? 50% would be normal. It's why female physicians have a different job than us male clinicians. It's a different kind of connection. But that means the female patients have to be more, the female docs have to be more comfortable because you're on the same clinic schedule as the male doc. Right? You can't say, tell everybody in the waiting room to go get a latte because I'm going to be spending some quality time with Kate. So we check for agreement. Does this make sense to you? Chad, how closely does this match up with what you thought I might be saying today? I know when you came, you've been treated for regular unipolar depression for some time.
But it sounds like Dr. Arnold, when he referred you to us, he was starting to be concerned that there was something about your depression that was a little different. That's a big provide, right? But now that we've had a chance to talk, Chad, I think Dr. Arnold's correct. I think you have not a unipolar, I think you have what we call a bipolar depression. The sleeplessness, the energy, the irritability for days on end, followed by that really heartbreaking black feeling. Those are the symptoms of manic depressive illness. I could go on, but don't. Turn to the guy and say, Chad, what goes through your mind as you hear me say that? And you're going to know what to do next based on what he says. And then we can go on and talk about it. In any event, that's checking for agreement. Using clear criteria is something we talked about a bit earlier. The doctors who do well, they take these subjective questions and they make them criteria. And the one I've gone on about that it bedevils my colleagues is all the patients who want a disability parking permit. Do people ask you for a disability parking permit? In this town, they probably ask for a disability horse kind of carriage permit. But in any event, we get a lot of parking permits. And when this becomes subjective, it gets ugly. You know, I don't understand. My neighbor has one. His doctor gave him one without questioning. Why are you putting me through all this? We just train our doctors to very calmly say, happy to consider it. State of Washington asks us to look at three criteria when a patient asks us for a disability parking permit. Let me tell you what those three criteria are, Mr. O'Connell, and let's go through them together to see where your situation fits. All of a sudden, by using four criteria, what we find is this vague, subjective, you know, if you liked me, you would give it to me, but you don't like me, so you won't, starts to diminish, because there's a logic to this. Four criteria that we use in filling out a total disability form. Let's see where your situation stands, right? Because if all the four criteria met, of course I'm willing to find the disability form. But I hope you can understand my signature is attesting to the fact that all four criteria are met. See what I'm doing? So let's go through the four criteria and see where your situation stands. And that's when we look at the patient and we say criteria number two is that there's no form of rehabilitation which would ever get you back to work, right? But since you haven't gone to physical therapy ever, right, we don't have an answer yet to the question, could it help? Could I make a suggestion, Kate? Right? My voice tone, I am calm, it is compassionate, and this is not a cheap trick, because I understand that this you're not liking what I'm saying. You wanted me to sign that freaking form, didn't you? And here I am saying, you know, Kate, can I make a suggestion? Let's get you in to see a good physical therapist for a course of physical therapy, and if that person says at the end there's no way that woman can go back and do that job, then of course I would sign that form. But right now, Kate, we don't have the answer to the question, and so I can't sign the form because signing the form would mean that question has been answered. And we look at each other lovingly, or I'm loving you, you're looking a little grumpy. But we got our work. And then I say to you, would you like me to make a referral today? This is not personal. Remember, the successful clinicians are personable. They are warm, they are empathic, they are compassionate, but they take nothing personally. Because the patient can schnooker you into all kinds. If you get your back up, if you get defensive, if you feel, you will misbehave every time. You are wired to do that. Your nervous system is wired to respond to threats, right, with adrenaline and cortisol. So don't get your back up. Don't take anything personally. It's not about you. Kate, you're not mad at me, right? You're mad at a doctor who you really wanted to sign that form today and who is telling you that without those criteria being met, the form would be meaningless. I could understand why you would be upset with a doctor. You see what I'm doing here? Now you could say you could do mindfulness-based stress meditation. You could go see your guru in India. You can do all kinds of stuff. You could take judo again, but you don't have to, because if you see what I just did, I'm creating a little distance between myself and my role. Most of the patients are not mad at you, the person. They're mad at the role. They're mad at the decision you made in the role. And you can empathize with that. You're upset with a surgeon. You've been struggling with this horrible pain. You've been on whopping doses of opiate. You finally got your primary care provider to refer you to us in orthopedics, and you were really hoping that we would have a surgical procedure that would offer you some chance of relief. Is that kind of what you wanted me to know? And the patient said, yes, yes, yes. So I imagine it's very disappointing to hear a surgeon tell you that there is no surgical procedure in your situation that offers a reasonable chance of getting you the results you want against the risk of making the problem worse. I'll bet that was disappointing news to get, was it? He's not mad at me. He doesn't know me. He's mad at an orthopedic surgeon who he had hoped was going to come up with some kind of procedure to save him from the suffering, and the guy is looking him right in the eye and saying, I don't have one. I would discourage you from allowing anybody to do a fifth back operation. Because what you've seen is every time they do one, the level above, the level below starts to deteriorate. And I think that's exactly what would happen. And I'm not a real doctor, so I forget how many levels you have. But you're probably going to run out of levels soon. Promoting adherence, here are the four words, and I'll leave you with this thought. And by the way, we have docs. These four words are so powerful. When I'm talking about adherence, we're getting to the end. We're making a deal. We use these four words because the psychology research will tell you that if you want to see, is a person going to commit themselves to a course of action, these are the four things that the human mind considers. Number one, so Chad, we've talked about a number of things in today's visit. And I guess I'm wondering, how convinced are you that your depression really does better fit this idea of a bipolar illness than the major depression for which your primary care doctor's been treating you? Now, Chad doesn't have to answer. He's already, his head is spinning. It's Friday afternoon. You know, he thinks he's crazy. But before I sell a treatment plan, let's do this in an orderly fashion. How convinced are you that this diagnosis I'm proposing is actually a better fit for the symptoms and the struggles you've had? If he's reasonably convinced, we can move on to the next question. So here's the next question. Chad, how convinced are you that changing from the Prozac to medicines that are better able to manage and stabilize the mood, which, by the way, are more complex medications with more side effects, but they have been demonstrated to be more effective at taking the highs and lows out of it. How convinced are you that starting one of those medicines today would be in your best interest? Notice I'm staying with conviction. If the patient's not convinced the diagnosis is accurate, and they're not reasonably convinced the treatment could help, they won't do it. And all I'm asking him to do is open his mouth and swallow a pill, right? It's that easy, fella. And he still won't do it if he's not convinced it's necessary, because all these things. Next question, if he's reasonably convinced, I want to see how confident is he that he could actually accomplish this. Because remember, think back to my earlier treatment plan. It included getting aerobic exercise. It included cutting down on the liquor. Come on now. Many patients would agree they drink too much, but if you ask how confident are you could drink less, they'd say no. You have a lot of patients who are heavier than they would prefer to be. If you said to them, how convinced are you the extra weight you're carrying is part of this problem, a lot of them would agree with you. But if you said to them, how confident are you could lose weight, you would see a different answer. But if they're reasonably convinced that losing weight would be helpful, then if I'm going to help them, I got to focus on their lack of confidence, right? So tell me a little bit more what you've tried in the past to lose weight, and I might have some ideas that might help. I always have ideas that might help, right? I mean, the Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, go to the clinic, see a bariatric surgeon. But I'm not going to throw ideas at a problem unless we're both reasonably convinced it's a problem worth dealing with. And I understand, how can I help you feel more confident? Last two items essential. Is this important enough for you to commit yourself to? That's the deal. Right? And we say, and I could say all four of these things to Chad, and I use the words regularly. So Chad, how convinced are you that bipolar is actually a better fit for what you've been struggling with for years than the unipolar depression? And I hope Chad says, no, you convinced me. The ups, the downs, it's true. It's, yeah, that's true. How convinced are you, Chad, that the changing to medicines that better manage stabilized mood, even though we're going to have to do liver studies and all kinds of stuff, increases the chances you can live as well as possible? Remember, whose goal are we trying to meet here? Not mine. I don't care if there's pay for performance at the University of Washington, if all of my patients take my medicines. No, we're here for him. How convinced are you your life would be better if it didn't have these ups and downs? And now I look at you and I say, so Chad, so before I type in the treatment plan, is this important enough for you to commit yourself to? And if he says yes, you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to type it out loud in front of him because it feels like a deal, right? When you type stuff and you print it out and you give it to somebody, it feels like a deal. And by the way, does that mean he's going to be taking Abilify and Seroquel when I see him in a month? I don't know. All I did was increase the chances that he would agree with the diagnosis and try the treatment plan. There's no magic here, no fairy dust, but you're smarter than that. And it is Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and you probably about had it. So let me ask, is this a good time to stop, or would you want to take a moment for a question or two, or is enough enough? Enough is enough. Thank you for letting me come and talk to you so much.